Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
That's all right, baby. That's all right for you. That's all right, baby. That's all right for you.
Hear that sound? You could call it the distant birth of rock and roll, and it is not Elvis in 1954. It's Joe Turner in 1938 singing It's All Right, Baby. The sound of the Chitlin circuit of African-American club and juke joint and dance hall music before it took center stage in American popular culture. And it's still alive and kicking. This hour on Point, the story and music of the Chitlin circuit. You can join the conversation. Was this, is this your playground, your grandparents' playground, the culture within a culture of the Chitlin circuit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear in this hour from the great Bobby Rush, who knows the circuit well and to this day. But joining me now from Memphis, Tennessee, is Preston Lauterbach, writer, music journalist, and author of a big new history, Black History, Prehistory of the Sounds Most of Us Grew Up With, The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. It's called, the Wall Street Journal calls it, a well-researched Valentine to a lost world of CD con men, promoters and club owners, the power brokers and hustlers who made the circuitry spark. Preston Lauterbach, it's great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Mark Anthony Neal, professor of Black popular culture at Duke University, author of What the Music Said and Songs in the Key of Black Life. Mark Anthony, thanks for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Preston, take us back to the beginning. When does, you know, some little thing going on, as you describe it, in nondescript places become the Chitlin Circuit?
Well, the way that it was organized initially was through segregated Black America, where segregation had concentrated Black commerce, whether in a small town or a big city, into one single district, and usually most of the activity centered on one main street. So even a smaller town like Muskogee, Oklahoma, had its Second Street. Memphis, which you mentioned earlier, had its Beale Street. And the people who lived, worked, and played on these streets in these districts called it the stroll. Now, every stroll had its kingpin. These were people like Don Roby in Houston, Sunbeam and Ernestine Mitchell in Memphis, Tennessee, mm-hmm. a lady named Red Ruby Edwards in the Mississippi Delta. These were entrepreneurs. They went outside the system and generated their finances through bootlegging, through gambling, through girls. As one of my sources told me, it was all part of the game. Every one of these kingpins had a nightclub, and these nightclubs networked together, formed the Chitlin Circuit.
Mark Anthony Neal, when you think about the Chitlin Circuit, do you think of a deep historical artifact? Do you think of something, I mean, we know, of course, it is alive right now, but what does it mean to you coming out of history? Was this the alternative venue for people who had faced Jim Crow and more for a long time and had, you know, no other great stage to perform this way?
It's absolutely an alternative venue, an alternative public sphere, if you will, that, as Preston just mentioned, you know, was really, you know, driven by, you know, Black aspiration and Black survival needs. You know, I'm one of the folks that, you know, I make the argument, you know, that when you think about the Chitlin Circuit, you know, the Chitlin Circuit arguably is indispensable to the development of American music and American culture, because it was indispensable to the survival of Black music and Black culture in this country. These rich networks of juke joints and clubs and various other things, you know, were where Black musicians had their opportunity to network with each other, but to also stay in contact with the people, you know, who supported them, their audiences. And, you know, in that really intimate interaction, the music always represented where the people were. I mean, that is exactly the value of the Chitlin Circuit. It always meant that the musicians and the artists were always in close proximity and were always in touch with the audiences they were playing for.
Let's hear some. This is from a USO broadcast for Black troops. This wasn't on the circuit, but this is definitely from the circuit. This is Joe Liggins and the Honey Drippers.
I've got a girl, says she loves me, so she says.
So she says.
Every night she's dreaming of me, so she says.
So she says.
I'm going to knock on her front door, going to find out what the score. I'll come. Don't love me like you used.
How come?
Ain't you still my baby?
How come?
You're running, running, dating. Leave me waiting. Baby, how come?
How come?
Here you go, Joe Liggins and the Honey Drippers. Now, Preston Lauterbach, paint some pictures for us of where we might have heard Joe and the Honey Drippers playing in their day on the circuit. What kind of venues? Paint a picture.
You would have heard them in every place from Haney's Big House, which was a barbecue stand, bar room, pool room in Faraday, Louisiana, which though it served African-American clientele, some of the white kids from town, namely a couple cousins named Jerry Lee Lewis and Jimmy Lee Swaggart, would sneak over on their bicycles and peer through the slats to hear what the artists like Joe Liggins were putting down in there. But they would have also played in places like the Apollo, the Howard Theater in Washington, D.C. So this was a whole sequence of places, from these little dusty ballrooms in the South all the way up to fine, ornately decorated theaters in well-populated northern cities.
And this is a very put-together sound, and this is not a small little group here. I can picture it. You described the Bronze Peacock Dinner and Dance Club in Houston, 8,000 square feet, wall-to-wall swank, you say. But it's harder to picture it in your converted, I don't know, tobacco barn in South Carolina. But was it there too, Preston?
Oh, absolutely. One of the more effective early promoters on the Chitlin circuit, one of the real visionaries behind its national scope, was a fellow named Denver Ferguson. One of his key innovations in promoting this music in some of the smaller, out-of-the-way venues, like the South Carolina Tobacco Barn or an industrial warehouse, was that he, understanding how the stroll that I mentioned earlier really functioned, knew that everybody was going to hang out in the barbershop and knew that everybody in town would pass through there. So he took barbers in small towns and made them promoters for his dances. If there wasn't a nightclub, why, he would just press a tobacco barn or a warehouse or some other type of facility. Elks Club was another famous spot into duty for one night.
Let's hear another little bit here. Louis Jordan, 1941, Knock Me a Kiss.
I like cake, and no mistake, but baby, if you insist, I'll cut out cake just for your sake. Baby, come on and knock me a kiss. I like pie.
I love jam and no flim flam. Mark Anthony Neal, it sounds like a zone of freedom. When maybe it around midnight, but freedom when there was not a whole lot of freedom to go around.
A relative freedom, if you will.
Yes, yes.
You know, you're talking about working class folks, you know, sometimes working 12, 14 hours a day, 60 hours a week, and, you know, their freedom was their leisure time, and they fought for that leisure time hard, and they played as hard as they fought for it. So the opportunity to be able to go and be adults, you know, be humans, and be able to feel what it was like to be a free adult in those kind of spaces, and of course, sexuality was a big part of that, you know, the freedom to be able to feel, literally, you know, in a sexual sense, but also, you know, the close intimacy, whether that be, you know, brotherhood or you know, other things. I mean, it was a very important space and very valuable. I often like to tell the story of Joe Sample, the great founder of the Jazz Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
He did a recording a few years ago with the bassist Marcus Miller on an album called Tales, and he tells a story of the Jazz Crusaders getting started and wanting to play jazz music, and they were opening for all of these big rhythm and blues acts in a barn, you know, in Texas.
Yep.
And they were playing jazz music and talked about how the folks who were in the audience, you know, paid 25 cents, and they all came up front and like, you know, we're not enjoying this, right? This is not music that we want to dance to. This is some jazz mess.
Yeah.
You know, if y'all don't play what we want to hear, you know, we're going to steal your instruments. We're going
to,
you know, steal your cards.
Now.
Y'all going to have to walk back home. And that was, it was real, you know, because people worked really hard. And the only time they would have would be these Friday and Saturday nights.
And they were,
you know,
three,
like
Ray
Charles said,
the
nighttime is the right time.
Right. And they were not far. Preston Lauterbach, Louis Jordan, huge in that world, Preston.
He was the big bang that began the evolution of rock and roll music. You don't listen to that record right there, Knock Me a Kiss, and think, wow, that sounds like Van Halen. But in terms of cultural trends, Louis Jordan was absolutely key. Couple big things. One, prior to Louis Jordan, big band swing was the vogue. Duke Ellington was by far the most influential cultural figure in black America throughout the 30s and early 40s. But Louis Jordan came along with a small band, a five-piece, and made just as much noise as Ellington did with his 18-piece. He also elevated the vocals. Before Louis Jordan, you know, Louis is a terrific lyricist, very clever and a silvery smooth singer, and could lay down a song. Before Louis Jordan's popularity really ascended, the vocalist was an afterthought. You know, it was all about the arranger, the composer, the hot soloist. So he initiated two key trends that evolved into rock and roll, even if you don't hear rock and roll on his records. He was a singer and a small band.
Made it visceral with the singer right out front. That small band, even in Depression years, could really move around this country, and it did on the Chitlin Circuit. Preston Lauterbach is with us. His great new history is The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Mark Anthony Neal joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Duke University, author of New Black Man and What the Music Said. Listeners, you can join us. Was this your world? Or far from it. Did you, do you, make the scene around midnight? Take us there. What made it? What makes it? Rock on the Chitlin Circuit. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Here's Peppermint Harris with I Got Loaded.
If you see my baby, tell her this for me. I didn't mean to stay so long, but the juice down there was free and I got loaded. I got loaded. I got loaded. Oh, I sure got high.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the music and the culture this hour of the Chitlin Circuit, the African-American clubs and joints and dance halls that became the crucible of American popular music. Preston Lauterbach joins us. His new book is The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. Writer and music journalist Mark Anthony Neal is with us, professor of black popular culture in the African and African-American Studies Department at Duke University, author of Back, Black Popular Culture and the Post-Soul Aesthetic. We're going to hear in this hour from the great Chitlin Circuit star with so many records under his belt. Bobby Rush will join us from Chicago in a few minutes. You can join us right now. Was this, is this your world? Did your grandparents swing with Louis Jordan, Joe Turner? Did they go wild for Big Mama Thornton right here, Roy Brown? What was, what is the magic of this then separate world? What story does this music tell about America? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And Preston, Mark Anthony Neal, here's Brett talking to us online. He says, Elvis Presley's Hound Dog pales in comparison to Big Mama Thornton's. But the Beatles, the Stones, on, they all owe something important, I'd say more than that, to these artists in this period in U.S. music history. Here's the real deal, Preston.
That's right.
It's unbelievable to hear just how directly the sort of, you know, white America saw Elvis as a revolution. But here, how many years before he came out with it is a very, you know, just fantastic down original version of the song.
Yeah, that's 3, 4, 5 years, somewhere in there before Elvis. And I think a really important distinction to make is that between rock and roll music and rock and roll culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, Elvis Presley is the king of rock and roll because he's the most popular artist in rock and roll history. You, me, no combination of people can change that. Bill Haley was a critical artist in his time. But these are the people that made rock and roll culture popular. The movies, the fainting, screaming teenage girls, all the trappings of 50s rock, the leather jackets, the pomade, the motorcycles, mm-hmm. the tough guys, and all that act. But rock and roll music, the music that really fueled that culture came from black America, came from before those artists were working, and that Big Mama Thornton track right there is just a perfect example.
Mark Anthony Neal, in our first segment, the music sounded pretty neat and poised and put together. Here it begins to get gnarly. You sort of get down that deep drum, that finger-snapping rhythm. I mean, this is what we think of, closer to what we think of in the juke joint, Mark.
Yeah, what we call rhythm and blues, you know, as Preston talks about, you know, really the direct descendant to rock and roll music, right? And again, you know, when you think about the kind of honky-tonks and places where this music is being performed to a live audience, right, you know, this is the early 1950s and Black America, you know, has gotten some semblance of freedom, you know, with their involvement in World War II and A. Philip Randolph and the March on Washington, you know, in 1941. And you can hear that desire for freedom in the music kind of pushing against the very neat boundaries, very sanitized boundaries, you know, that Black America largely had to operate within, you know, prior to the 1950s.
Let's get a little more from that feeling. This is Bite Again, Wynonie Harris, walking that bass, the saxophone coming in here. Here we go. Bite Again, Bite Again.
Well, would you believe what I'm going to tell for you? Well, would you believe what I'm going to tell you? Baby, if you don't watch out, yes, and if he ever bites you, here's what you sing and shout. Bite again, bite again, bite again, bite again, bite again.
And he goes right on to talk about love, careless love, in the middle of Bite Again, Bite Again. Wynonie Harris. Let me get a caller right here, Lisa in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Thanks for calling, Lisa. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because if Tyler Perry would argue with you, there's no such thing as a Chitlin's circuit. It's just people going to be entertained in their theaters.
Yes, and that's what they had, and that's where they were. Well, what about it? Preston, let me take it first to you. I haven't heard Tyler Perry say it, but Lisa has. There's no such thing as Chitlin's circuit. Just folks going out.
I guess I have a problem that there's any kind of negative connotation to that term, Chitlin Circuit. I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of when you look at the rich legacy of the culture. And if you study the brilliant business people that orchestrated this, there's nothing to be ashamed of about it.
How did it work? It was a circuit certainly in the sense that you had people making the rounds. They were in a network. How were they traveling? How many would be in the circuit at a given time? How did they promote it before the artist came to town? How did they get paid?
Well, that last question was the key one, of course, and the creative energy really followed the money on the Chitlin circuit. This was before records had really become major money makers for Black artists. They couldn't really think about getting rich in a recording studio, so they had to work one-nighters all across the map. Now, I mentioned those kingpins earlier. They functioned also as regional promoters. So like the kingpin of Memphis, Sunbeam Mitchell, not only had his club on Beale Street, but he had affiliations in Mississippi, Arkansas, and up the road from Memphis in West Tennessee. And so Sunbeam and a lot of these other promoters would buy, take Wynonie Harris's touring, the artist that we're listening to in the background here. Wynonie is touring. Sunbeam would buy not just one night of Wynonie, but he'd buy 10 nights, right? And cycle him through. It's like a hub and spoke system. Sunbeam is the hub at Memphis. He would cycle him through his spokes and then pass him off to the next promoter. And they worked pretty well collaboratively, these promoters. There were some competition and some scrapes between them because there was money involved.
These were strong entrepreneurs. Some real fortunes made in this period, Preston, as you describe.
Yeah, and the more versatile kingpins tended to weather the storms and the changes during the culture during this period.
Versatile. Now that's funny because versatile has a lot under its hat. You talk about the numbers racket, hair straighteners,
right.
Murders, human catastrophe, commercial sex, bootlegging, international scandal, female impersonation. That sounds like versatility.
Well, they had a lot of fun. one of my favorite kingpins was a man named Don Roby, who was in Houston, Texas, started off as a big band promoter in the 30s and ended up being the most successful Black record man from the 50s until he was bought out in the 70s. His credo, because he was of mixed race heritage, and felt that what he thought were the best of both of those worlds were imbued in his character, would say, I am a black man and a white man. I'll kick your and outsmart you. And that was, I'm sorry?
It had a 45 in his belt if that was necessary.
to back it up.
You've got a chapter called The Loser Goes to Hospital, The Winner Goes to Jail. I mean, Wynonie Ryder was part of that kind of wild party.
Yeah.
Harris, excuse me. Had that wild party thing going on, that mystique, drinker, fighter, romancer.
He was one of the first wild men in that rocker character. He's a funny guy. He would see one of his bandmates strolling with a gal on his arm outside of the theater before a show and walk up to her and say, excuse me, miss, this no good son of a gun is married to my sister.
You know? That'll get it started.
There was another performer who he worked with on the circuit who could not read or write, and Wynonie would get on stage and grab the microphone and say, sign this autograph for me. You know, he was a mischievous guy. But a tender heart behind all of his bluster, so we're told.
Let's go to Jackie calling from Naugatuck, Connecticut. Jackie, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I listen to the radio station all the time. I love you guys. I've never called. This is the first time calling in. I'm interested in the subject today. I mean, I'm interested in all the subjects, but this is close to home because I've been a musician for 45 years, a bass player. I started off in the late 60s.
Wow.
And I did the Chitlin Circuit for the longest time, for many years. I was in an all-black band, and we did the Chitlin Circuit everywhere, military bases from Pensacola, Florida, to Fort Pease, Maine, and everything in between. We did the cotton clubs. We did a lot of stuff.
What was it like to be out there, Jackie? So you were right in the middle of it, playing bass. What was it like to be on the circuit?
Oh man, it was beautiful. It kept me out of trouble because I came from here from North Carolina, but I grew up in Bridgeport, and almost all of my peers were either dying from overdoses or whatever. And I think the thing that kept me out of trouble was my love for music, and we just played all the time, and we did the Chitlin Circuits, which are like the clubs where they wouldn't hire you. If you were black, you got hired there, and there were no blacks really playing in white clubs. There wasn't too much crossover then, and I actually seen it go from the Chitlin Circuit thing to crossing over, and we had a big article in Seymour, Connecticut, where some newspaper man wrote about our band, about the fact that we were the first black band to play in Seymour, and how dare we, was it going to go off and everything, and the place was packed for the whole weekend.
I'm looking at a picture here from Preston Lauterbach's book, The Chitlin Circuit, and it's riot police on the Rialto. This is a Memphis police patrol on Beale Street in March 1968. They're marching east past Sunbeam Mitchell's club there. What was it like, Jackie, to be in that part of the country playing in those years?
You had to be quiet. You didn't do any talking. The manager did all the talking. You would just play your music. Some people would respect you because of your ability, and they would talk to you. But you kind of stayed away from different kind of people that didn't want to see you doing it and stuff. So that's why you stayed in your black areas and stuff. And then police always pulling you over, trying to make you take everything out of the car, saying you got drugs. No, I don't, sir. I'm just playing, and I'm from wherever I was from the north and stuff. And they'd be like what you doing out here, boy? But the people that we play for, they appreciate it a lot.
And right in the face of that, some really great music. Jackie, we appreciate your call a lot. Thank you so much for calling in. Let's get a little more taste. This is Roy Brown, 1949, Boogie at Midnight.
Well, you like to boogie and I like the blues. Come on, put on our dancing shoes. We're gonna boogie at midnight.
Roy Brown, Boogie at Midnight. Mark Anthony Neal, I wonder about the power of this music and this circuit in pulling the African-American community together. I mean, it ran right into the era when Martin Luther King would be out in the streets with protesters. Was there a kind of rallying going on here at the same time people were partying, Mark Anthony Neal?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are at play. You know, first of all, to think of it, you know, the Chitlin' Circuit is something that's really much more expansive than what was happening in terms of rhythm and blues music and blues music. You know, the earliest incarnations of the Chitlin' Circuit really are the beginning of the 20th century, and folks like Bert Williams and all those folks that were booked on the theater booking agency, you know, which the artists themselves joked as being the experience of tough on black asses. And so, yeah, there's a business model there, and it's a business model that you attack to the Negro Leagues. Mm-hmm. You know, all these folks trying to take advantage of black buying power to empower black communities. Mm-hmm. And very often, these loose elements, even as they're trying to, on their hustle, trying to make their money making music, you know, they also become folks who become very supportive, particularly in a place like Memphis, of efforts like the Civil Rights Movement, like Martin Luther King. That same network that was used in order to promote shows would be the same network that would be used when Martin Luther King came to town and was given a speech, would be the same network that would be used to get folks to come out to a church, you know, for an organizational meeting. What you really see is what the Chitlin' Circuit almost best represents is how black communities were already thinking about social media, if you will, you know, throughout the 20th century before we could actually talk about something physically like social media in terms of Twitter and Facebook.
Roy Brown there with Boogie at Midnight. Of course, he popularized the term rocking with his 1947 hit Good Rockin' Tonight, but it wasn't always that rockin' sound. Here's Pledging My Love, Johnny Ace, 1955, posthumous here.
Forever, my darling, my love will be true. Always and forever, I'll love just you.
Justin Lauterbach, what's going on with this sweet sugar sound here, this sort of mellow sweet?
If you don't mind, I want to jump back on that previous point, the Civil Rights Chitlin' Circuit corollary. There was one figure in particular who was very powerful in both worlds. He was located in New Orleans, Louisiana. Name was Rip Roberts. He was one of the key promoters there during the late 40s. While he was promoting dances for Lucky Millinder, Roy Brown, he was one of Fats Domino's early beneficiaries and managers. He was also sponsoring voting drives.
And so he was right on top of that kind of crossover there from music to culture and political power.
He was a community leader, and he embraced his responsibility in that regard. So it wasn't just entirely about the hustle to everyone.
Sonny
Mitchell in Memphis was another political figure of sorts. And Sunbeam, in fact, was getting back to Johnny Ace, the sweet sound that we're hearing here. Sunbeam was one of Johnny's early champions. Johnny actually came under the control of two of the more powerful men on the circuit, the aforementioned Don Roby and Sunbeam Mitchell, who took this kid from really a street kid who hung around outside of Sunbeam's nightclub and made him a star. His first record came out in 1952, was recorded just by happenstance and caught on as a hit. He had number one hit after number one hit. He was really a phenomenon. Part of his popularity is attributable to the rise of black radio during this time period. He came up with B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland at WDIA Radio in Memphis, Tennessee.
Of course, the radio would ultimately pull away some of the glow of the Chitlin' Circuit when the records could go right out over the radio and were done in the studio and not necessarily in the club. We'll look at that and a lot more. When we come back, we're going to hear from the great R&B performer, Bobby Rush himself. Preston Lauterbach is with us today. His new book is The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. Joins us from Memphis, Tennessee, from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Mark Anthony Neal is with us, author of What the Music Said. Listeners, you can join us. What is the magic of this world? And what story does this music and the culture around it tell us about America? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We'll go out with Rocket 88, 1951, Jackie Brenston and his Delta Cats. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
step in my rocket and don't be late. Baby, we're pulling out about 8:30. Going round the corner and hit a fifth. Everybody in my car's gonna take a little nip. Move on out, oozing and cruising along.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the music and culture of the Chitlin' Circuit, the African-American clubs and joints that became the crucible of American popular music. Little Richard behind us right there, Tutti Frutti, 1955. You can join the conversation this hour. Can you hear how this just came up and up and up? And how did this once marginalized culture take over the musical culture of this country? Is that you still out there at the juke joint today, living it up? Do you have to go to a joint anymore? It's everywhere. 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. We're joined today by Preston Lauterbach. He's author of the new book, The Chitlin' Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. And from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, by Mark Anthony Neal, professor of black popular culture at Duke University. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Let's get Pedro in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Pedro, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing, and your folks, your listeners? I just wanted to share a small point. Although, you know, most of these songs we consider oldies, you know, I would imagine that a lot of your listeners are a lot older. Well, actually, in the Hispanic community, it still has a big following, real huge following.
Are you talking about this music right here, Pedro?
Oh, yes, right there, yes. Anything from the 60s, I mean, 50s and 60s, even up to the 70s, we still follow it. I mean, you know, the Art LeBeau, I'm sure you heard of Art LeBeau, right?
Uh-huh.
The Art LeBeau show, that's what he plays, nothing but oldies, and he has such a great following, a huge following in the community. But what people generally call Chicanos.
Yeah, it just doesn't go away. Still popular right there. We're going to hear in just a moment from the great Bobby Rush, Pedro. Appreciate your call. Bill in Essex Junction, Vermont. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm 51 years old, and I grew up in Connecticut, which means that I grew up in the 70s, which means that my music back then was pretty much disco, which means that I grew up in sort of a musical void. But now I'm taking guitar lessons, and I'm doing a lot of music theory. And what I'm discovering is that if I look at any of the music, you know, if it's Led Zeppelin or Eric Clapton, or I'm studying any of this stuff, you know, it all goes back to the pentatonic scales and the modes. And it's my nature. I ask, well, where did this come from? How did this get discovered? And I'm finding that most of the scales that we know went back to the monks of the 13 and 1400s. And then most of the scales and the modes that we know, like the pentatonic scale laid over a scale, actually goes back to these musicians.
So should we say discovered or stolen, Bill? Which
well,
is the right
you know,
word?
Adapted, I think, is the word I'm looking for. In a large sense, one of your guests said that, you know, they didn't create rock and roll culture, but they created rock and roll music. And what I'm discovering that they did was they made one of the most profound changes in music theory that we've seen since the 1400s. And really, you can look at any music today, and if you really break it down and sort of a 1-4-5 kind of a rhythm, which is very popular in rock and roll music, or a pentatonic scale over an A or a C scale, you know, this sort of music theory, you can trace it directly back to these musicians. So I'm loving this show. It really just is illustrating and illuminating all of the music that I'm learning about now.
Hey, Bill, we really appreciate your call, and we're going to go right from the theoretical to the anything but theoretical, if I may. And thanks for calling, but joining us right now, and we're so happy to have him, from Chicago, is the great Bobby Rush, major R&B performer, hundreds of records out there, all kinds of awards to his name, best male soul blues artist, and right on down. He calls himself the king of the Chitlin' Circuit, and he is still out there performing, and I mean really performing. Check out the video at our website, onpointradio.org. Bobby Rush in Chicago, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Tom. How are you guys doing over there? And I appreciate your show. Like what you're doing, like where you're coming from. I think we can add some pointers and things to what you're doing.
We're just so very pleased to have you. Tell us just how much you're doing, work you're doing on the circuit today, Bobby. How many gigs a year?
Well, I haven't done 250 shows a year for the last 55 years. So I'm traveling all across the country. I'm trying to cut down to 200 a year, but it's hard to do because everybody wants to see a Bobby Rush, especially for the weekend.
Right.
Talk about the Chitlin' Circuit, you're talking about mostly weekend work, you know.
Sure.
And sometimes two shows a night, you know.
200 doesn't sound like a very small lineup. It sounds like a lot of work.
No, it's not. You know, let me say before we get too far in the interview.
Yes, sir.
Let me thank you for what you have done, what you're doing, what you plan to do, because pulling the cup off of this idea about the Chitlin' Circuit is something great. But I want to set the record straight. The Chitlin' Circuit ain't nothing that we as a musician, especially that came up with. It's just a place to work,
mm-hmm.
a place to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody named the Chitlin' Circuit. Let me tell you, in 1951, when I kind of started, 1949 and 1951, they used to feed us hamburgers. They went, our first gig I had, myself and Elmo James, they didn't pay us to play. They give us $1 a night, and we will have four or five hamburgers. If we play well, we get eight hamburgers.
Oh, my goodness.
We'll sell seven hamburgers and eat one. So that means we're selling for 25 cents a piece. We have $1.75 like that.
Oh.
And that's where we're. And then on Friday and Saturday with chicken and chitlins. That was the guts of the hall.
Right,
and,
sure.
And they were really, that's where this come from. Now then white writers as a whole and white radio station got into a situation where we're going to call it the Chitlin' Circuit because it was supposed to have been something less than something else.
Huh. So but you call yourself king of the Chitlin' Circuit, I'm reading here.
Well, that's what they called me, and I agree. When how this came by, I was doing an interview about 25 years ago with a very popular TV show, and they were doing it at my house, and so my oldest granddaughter was just a little 5 or 6 year old kid. She was at the table interrupting me because I was keeping her. So the gentleman was interviewing me. So, Bobby Rush, why do they call you the king of the Chitlin' Circuit? Before I could answer them, my little granddaughter said, Granddaddy, what do I look like? I said, you look like a rabbit. And she said, I do, Granddaddy, I do. She was proud to look like a rabbit because her granddaddy said so. Because it was something to be nice. So then she quieted down. So be quiet. Let me do the interview. Then the gentleman said, put the microphone back to my face. He said, Bobby Rush, are you proud to be a Chitlin' Circuit? I said, sure I am. Sure I am. Because what my little grandbaby said.
Right.
Now what they had planned to do was ask me about the Chitlin' Circuit because they were approaching me as something less than something else. Now I'm proud to be this Chitlin' Circuit artist. Now they can't say what they want to say to me about the Chitlin' Circuit because I'm proud to be.
And that wasn't just any television show. I believe that was 60 Minutes you were talking
right.
there, Bobby Rush.
That's right. That's right. That's what it was, you know. And so I was proud to be who I am because I'm one of the few guys who proud to be a musician, who proud to be a blues singer, and proud to be a black blues singer. And I don't bite no bones about that because I get so tired of hearing a black entertainer and musician say, well, I'm going to record this because I think this is what black people like. I'm going to record like this because I think this is what white people would like.
Mm.
Well, I record good music, and I hope everybody like it. It's not a black and white issue with me. It's about the music.
Bobby Rush, let me go to a caller while we've got you. And it's just great to have you here. Pat in Shelburne, Vermont. Pat, thanks so much for calling. You're on the air with Bobby Rush, Preston Lauterbach, Mark Anthony Neal. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in Water Valley, Mississippi, 100 miles south of Memphis. 1952 to 1956 high school, listening to all this music coming out of Memphis, WDIA. My mama thought I was sleeping. I had the radio right up to my ear. And we knew nothing. My 52 to 56, we didn't think about it being black or white. It was just different music. We loved it. We'd go out on the bridges and turn the radios up. And then when I got to Memphis, I was old enough to go over to West Memphis to the Juke Joints, Danny's Club, the Plantation Inn, and I don't know what artist I actually saw. As we say, they were probably coming out of the Delta up to Memphis, headed to Detroit, and we would just throw nickels and dimes or dollars or whatever on the floor after they'd sing. And it was just the music. It had, we didn't think about it being black or white, but I guess our parents did. But my generation of kids, we just loved it until this day.
Just got you going, Pat. I hear that. I got to get some more of it right on the floor right here. Here's O.B. Wright, Eight Men, Four Women. This is 1967.
I dreamed that love was a crime. I was alone. So lonely and blue. You know why? Because eight men and four women.
O.B. right there. We'll hear some Bobby Rush in just a second here. And can't wait. Bob in Nashville, Tennessee. Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
Thanks for calling. I'm sitting here doing my work, and I listen to this music, and that reminds me of 1957. I was graduating from a suburban high school. And we walk into the prom, and here's this all-black band playing, and we had never seen anything like that before. To this day, I can just remember that night and picture those fellas up there, and it was completely different music than we were used to.
Were you in a white school? Were you in a white school with this all-black band? And were you?
No, but you know, it was mixed. It was big, 4,000 kids.
Yeah. And there it was. It took you away.
It's just so clear in my mind, and I thought to myself, this is a big deal. This is a change. That's how it felt.
Yeah, the change did come. Bobby Rush, did you feel like part of a change, or do you just feel like you're playing for...
I wasn't doing it for the change. I was doing it because it felt good at the time, and I was crossing over, because I always wanted to cross over to a white audience, but I didn't want to cross out the black audience. So I saw so many guys in my age bracket who crossed over to a white audience, but then they crossed out the black audience, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to cross over, but I didn't want to cross out.
Preston Lauterbach, how do you look at Bobby here in this sort of lineage? We've got Little Richard and O.B. Wright and so many. Where does Bobby Rush fit in, Preston?
Bobby, on one hand, is classic. I mean, I listen to Bobby and I hear Louis Jordan. I look at Bobby and his colorful suits and his dancers, and I see Little Richard. And yet, Bobby is his own original thing. There is only one Bobby Rush.
Here's Bobby Rush with Sue, a big, big hit, modeled after Louis Jordan's Caledonia, maybe, but it's its own Bobby Rush signature folk funk. Here it is.
Everybody call me a fool. But everybody is somebody's fool. Some said you love me, some said you don't. But don't make no difference when you're getting what you want.
When you're getting what you want. Bobby Rush, you've called yourself the freest blues man alive. What do you mean when you say that?
Well, because I don't have the manager, I don't have the record company to tell me when to go and what to do. But I do have a boss that is the public, and I try to guide myself into what the public would expect me to do and what they'd like to see me do. And I kind of studied the public through the years, and I think the public want to hear the trueness of a musician, of an entertainer. And that's what I try to project for them. And I think that's where I stand, you know?
Bobby Rush, you're terrific. You've been terrific for a long time. We're honored to have had you with us today, and we're so grateful to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Let me say before, the lady, the lady called, says she didn't think the Chilling Circuit exists, but have you.
Yeah.
It do exist. The Chilling Circuit, wow, it's just in a different form. It's almost like Tom, playing records. If you've been in radio for a long time, you remember when we had the 45s and,
sure.
and the 8-tracks and so on and so on. Now
yes,
we got
do.
The digital stuff going. But what it's just almost like a bathroom. You know, you modify a bathroom from 1800s. You know what you did in the bathroom then? You do the same thing at a mountain. You change the look of the bathroom, but you don't change what you do inside the bathroom.
Bobby, you're one of a kind. We're grateful to you for being with us from Chicago today. Thank you so much for being there. Bobby Rush and Sue behind us right here. Let's get one more caller. David at Chesapeake, Virginia. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It was really nice having Bobby Rush on there. I mean, also him... And setting the story straight, I think, you know, I followed music a long time, and I'm only 44, but, you know, I do see a lot of the middle-aged to younger black generation, you know, seeming to have to claim this white or black origination thing of music. And, you know, something with A&E that came out last year where they kind of did a, you know, did this follow-up on music and, you know, over the years, all the way back to, like, the 1800s and, you know, like from the cowboy era and all of that.
Yep.
And, they even went, you know, even went to originations of things. For instance, like, you know, everybody's always heard that, you know, who's up in the house or who's in the house
right,
tonight.
Right.
That phrase actually was coined on the Dick Clark show, on the second show that opened.
Well, all right. So a little claim for Dick Clark right there. And we've got it. David, I appreciate your call. Mark Anthony Neal, what about this scene now? If you go out to find it, you know, Tyler Perry may say there's no such thing, but Bobby Rush is out there playing and playing a lot. Is it still alive and vigorous?
From my standpoint, yes. I mean, Tyler Perry actually, ironically, is a great example that, you know, Tyler Perry staged plays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things that, you know, predated his films were classic Chitlin' Circuit. You know, he used the very network strategies that folks have been using on the Chitlin' Circuit, you know, for 70
mm-hmm.
or 80 years.
Mm-hmm.
One of the artists that Preston talks about that I have a great affection for, the late Marvin Cease, you know, another great example of somebody who maintained that career with virtually no mainstream radio airplay, no airplay on black radio stations, but he had that Chitlin' Circuit network that kept him out there with great songs like Candy Liquor, you know, for, you know, 25 years.
Is it behind us, Preston? And what about the legacy? We've just got half a minute here, but how do you define it?
No, it is not behind us. I wish I had Bobby Rush's gift for colorful analogy.
Mm.
But as long as there is that audience that isn't being served by the mainstream idea of what pop music should be, as long as there are grown folks out there that want to party and cut loose on Friday and Saturday night, just like they did 70, 80 years ago, there will always be a demand for the Chitlin' Circuit.
And so on it goes. It was really interesting to read about this history. It's a terrific piece of work you've done with this book, Preston Lauterbach, and we're grateful to you for being with us today and sharing a bit of it with us. Thank you so much for joining us from Memphis.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Preston Lauterbach, author of The Chitlin' Circuit and The Road to Rock and Roll, and Mark Anthony Neal at Duke University joining us today from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. It is always great to have you here, and thank you very much for chipping in today.
Thank you, Tom.
Mark Anthony Neal. We'll go out with Mel Waiters, Hole in the Wall, 1999. Kind of current anthem, much in the theme of the classic Chitlin' Circuit celebrations, talking about the small clubs on the circuit and all the fun and trappings. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Let's go, baby. Can we go to the hole in the wall? Mm-hmm. I've had my best time, y'all. The whole